Shelley, we ready?
We'll call the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor to order. And good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Nice to have you all back.
Nice to be back.
I just thought I would mention we do have one former member missing, and I miss Mike. He was a great person for me to work with, and hated to see him leave. I think he contributed an enormous amount to our agenda this last session, and it was a great person to work with. And so I thought we probably ought to acknowledge that, and I want to wish him continued success, and we'll miss him.
Mm-hmm. I would just second that, Mr. Chair. Mike certainly is a big part of this committee. I think he's been a good friend of Oregon business and labor over the years, and certainly do wish him well in whatever responsibilities he has in the days to come.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Second thing is we're also missing another member, a new member, and that's my new co-chairman, Chris Garrett. Representative Chris Garrett is new co-chair, and we hope he's having fun. He's out goofing off on vacation, and we have met and talked about today's agenda and agreed upon it, and I'm anticipating a good relationship with Chris, too. I think very impressive was his co-chairing the reapportionment committee. And when that's successful for the first time in 70 years, he must possess some rather outstanding skills. So we'll be looking forward to working with him a little bit as we finish out this interim session and the February session. So
I would like to thank the chair for coffee this morning.
Ah, you're most welcome. It's an appreciate it. Thank you. It was seemed like a nice courtesy. I have to blame Representative Greenleck for his bad example in healthcare, and I found it very nice and enjoyable, and I thought maybe a good idea should be emulated. So any other items for the good of the order before we proceed? And as I've mentioned, there is some coffee and some treats up here, and we have a small group today, so you're welcome to help yourselves. With that, let's proceed with our first item of business. It's Article 9, Universal Commercial Code. Elaine Shetterly and Wendy Johnson are here. And let's proceed with this topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for the coffee this morning. That's very nice of you. I'll try not to spill on Travel Oregon's computers.
Given budget woes, I think they'll appreciate that.
For the record, I'm Lane Shetterly, attorney over in Dallas, here this morning in my capacity. Actually, I'm wearing two hats, one as chair of the Oregon Law Commission and one as commissioner from Oregon on the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, otherwise known as the Uniform Law Commission. With me is Wendy Johnson. Wendy is the Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. Just a couple of comments about those organizations and how they come to you. In this case, the Uniform Law Commission, the national group, is an organization of the states. States appoint members to the Uniform Law Commission, and it functions as a law drafting, not a law making, but a law drafting body. It drafts laws for state legislatures to enact, and by enacting them, to achieve a uniform system of laws in areas where uniformity is useful and important. Doing this by state action, not by federal fiat, but by states themselves adopting these and then enacting them at the state level. One of the signature products of the Uniform Law Commission is the Uniform Commercial Code. The concept being that commerce and business is facilitated when there is a uniform system of laws from state to state, so that a manufacturer selling goods in Oregon, selling goods into Texas, has confidence what those laws are and that the manufacturer's rights are going to be respected in that sister state and vice versa. So for years, the Uniform Law Commission's Uniform Commercial Code has been a foundation of interstate commerce in the country. We are before you today just to discuss for shortly recent amendments to Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. The reason that we're before you is that we've approached co-chair Garrett about introducing this these amendments as a bill in the February session, and I'll get to why the timing of that is important, but we wanted to let you know what these are. Yeah. The Uniform Law
Let me interrupt you.
Yep.
Thank you, Lane. And it is the Uniform Commercial Code rather than Universal.
Uniform, that's right.
Okay, good.
Now, it has not been adopted in one
mark. Mr. Chair, yes, there is a typo in the agenda, so my apologies.
Is that right? I didn't even see it.
Yes, there is a typo, yes.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so I just wanted to clarify, it should read Uniform Commercial Code.
We're lobbying Mars, but it hasn't been adopted there yet.
It probably should. It's on its way to maybe becoming global. Let's see. I thought we really ought to clarify that.
I heard that, but it went right over, and I didn't even see it on the agenda. At the state level, the state has created the Oregon Law Commission to implement an ongoing program of law revision and law reform. And one of the sources that the statute actually directs the Law Commission to look at is acts promulgated by the Uniform Law Commission. And so we've had a recent adoption of proposed amendments to Article 9 of the UCC by the National Commission. The Oregon Law Commission is in the process of vetting those, adjusting them for style, primarily for Oregon. We've got a couple of options that are proposed in the Uniform Act that the states can choose, and the Oregon Law Commission has a work group in place that is preparing a bill that will enact the appropriate version of the Article 9 amendments. Article 9 deals with secured interests in personal property, so that when a business person borrows money from a bank, typically a bank will take a security interest in that business's inventory, maybe some other personal property. And Article 9 is the section of the Uniform Commercial Code that governs how that security interest is perfected, and in the event of a default, how it is foreclosed, and priorities. It's a central feature of commercial finance and has been part of the Uniform Commercial Code from the very beginning of the code. About 10 years ago, there were some significant amendments to Article 9 of the UCC. In the past 10 years, through various court decisions around the country and just developments of technology, too, it was perceived by the Uniform Law Commission that we needed to make some amendments to it just to bring it up to date address technological matters, and also, as I say, just to respond to some court cases. And so you have what I would call a pretty technical amendment to Article 9 in these Article 9 amendments that will be coming forward to you. You've got some written testimony, and I won't go through. There's just a couple of points that are more substantive than others. One of the questions that's come up under Article 9 is the name by which a debtor is reflected in the on the security financing document. What happens is you've got a situation where, let's say, a business person goes to a bank, is going to want to apply for a loan. The bank wants to know, has this person already encumbered their inventory, their personal property, their equipment, whatever it is that the bank may be taking a security interest in. The bank runs a search with the Secretary of State, which is where the UCC financing statements are filed, and enters that person's name. Of course, people go by different names. You may have used a middle initial. You may not always use a middle initial. You may have had a different last name years past. So the amendments to Article 9 address rules for how a person's name is to be reflected on the financing statement, so that there will be some clarity as to the security interest under that person's name. We have two options that the Uniform Act gives the states, actually. One is requires that an individual's name be exactly the name that appears on that person's driver's license. The other is a safe harbor rule that allows that, but also authorizes recognizes that other versions of the name may be used and would be valid for security interests. We've got a work group that is evaluating those options and will be making a recommendation in the legislation. Most of the rest of this is much more technical. Again, a lot of it dealing with the advances in technology that have occurred in the past 10 years and how those affect filing and security interests and searches. I don't know, Wendy, do you want to say any more about it? And what I want to say, too, the reason we're asking you to do this in the February session is that when these amendments were adopted by the National Uniform Law Commission in 2010, there is a projected uniform enactment date, uniform effective date for these amendments of July 1, 2013. Again, being uniform and national, it's important that states move together in this, right, and that we not lose the important element of uniformity that we have by some states moving forward, some states moving not, and some states moving on different dates. And so there is a uniform effective date projected of July 1, 2013. If we enact this next year, that will give make sure that we're under the time limit to have ours in place, and then allow the Secretary of State and practitioners just to adjust and prepare for the modest changes that would occur through this. But that's the reason we're asking to do this in the special session, just because you have an effective date that wouldn't be so well accommodated in the regular session coming up in 2013. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions. We'll be back, of course, with the Act itself after the work group has prepared it for introduction, and we'll have a fuller discussion then, but that's what it's about.
Yes. Thank you. Part of the reason we did choose to move forward, well, we first of all appreciate being asked to look at this issue, and then obviously the timeliness is important. Let's start with Representative Esquivel has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Lane, when we go to the to check on the filings, wouldn't we, I'm confused on why there's some any confusion on names, especially when it comes to like the judicial system, where someone may have some sort of an outstanding sort of a lien or something against themselves for child support or whatever. When we use a Social Security number, I don't understand that, because usually it proves to be someone else, but yet there's still confusion. Why is there confusion if they use a Social Security number?
Well, the searches are done by name, not by Social Security number.
But I mean, couldn't we solidify that by doing a Social Security number? So that way, if you had, like, I use SC Esquivel, I use Sal C. Esquivel, I use SC Esquivel Jr. Wouldn't that be the
You're
way to solidify it? I'm part of the problem. I understand that.
How many aliases do you have, Rep?
I've been down this road.
AKA. Exactly. Who are you?
Safe Harbor alternative actually would cover your. It's very. That's a perfect example of the kind of nomenclature that people use in the real world. I would just say that this goes back to, I think, probably the uniformity of this. The Uniform Act does not use Social Security number, and I would expect that nationally there'd probably be some pushback for states to do that. For Oregon to adopt a Social Security standard would put us way out of uniformity in application, and actually could affect then the. Our participation in this national system of financing statements. I wouldn't do that unless there was unless it was a uniform amendment to the Act, so that all states were doing it. Otherwise, if we go on basis of Social Security number and call that out as a basis on which identification and priority can be made, then we would be out of sync with the other 49 states that I think are not going there. Right now, the focus is on names. That's what has come up in the past 10 years, and that's the easy fix, probably. Someday, I suppose, you could look at the Social Security number as an identifying factor in UCC searches, but I wouldn't do it on our own today.
Ms. Johnson, Representative Johnson.
But is this just in the state of Oregon that this filing is done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, no. You may be borrowing from a bank out of state, and they would be utilizing the Oregon system for search. Or you may have interstate, for instance, finance or a finance company financing your inventory that's not an Oregon company. Or if you've got a relationship with a manufacturer of goods and you're a retailer here in Oregon and they're taking a security interest in your goods, these are all cross-border. And that's why the uniformity is so important, because these transactions, they do happen all within the borders, but a great number of them happen in cross-border situations where you've got parties in different states.
Ms. Johnson, do you want to introduce yourself for the record? And
Chair Kemmerer, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission. The code covers debtors, whether they be an individual or a business or an estate or a trust, and so that term name is used throughout. And I think it's about 60% of the debtors are actually an organization rather than an individual, so this term name is clarified not just for the individual but also for businesses and trusts. You'll see several amendments just to clear up the whole area of name of the debtor. And of course an organization wouldn't have a Social Security number either.
Oh, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. Any further questions or comments?
Good.
I do think time is of the essence, and Chris and I should probably say co-chair Chris Garrett and I have had a discussion about this, and we would anticipate using one of our five committee bills to introduce this topic for the 2012 legislative session. Yes, Representative
Just a
Johnson.
Comment, Mr. Chair, appreciate that, and it's good that we clarified that we're contemplating uniform legislation rather than universal legislation.
Yes.
as significant and accomplished as this committee is, I don't think we're ready to achieve at that level yet.
I think we're ready for the world.
Bring on. Yeah.
Well, you know, some of us do know how the world should be, so perhaps.
Amen. There you go.
If I can teach the world to sing.
Yeah, I guess we probably can't teach the world to sing. Anything else for the good of the order on this topic? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your courtesies. Very much.
Yeah. And committee, just a comment on this topic, too, on the topic of bill introductions. At the end, we'll have a moment to discuss that, too. So anything you wish to talk about committee bill introductions, we can do it at that time. Our second presentation is the impact of the wine industry on Oregon's economy. I think we're going to take this a little out of order, so we'll have Todd Davison, the Executive Director of Travel Oregon, start us off. Okay, if you'll introduce yourself for the record, and let's proceed.
Happily. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Davidson, and I have the privilege and pleasure of serving as the Executive Director of Travel Oregon, which is the Oregon Tourism Commission. I have to start by saying that I'm very pleased that then-Representative Shetterly did not spill his coffee all over our laptops, given the fact that The Travel Oregon is now funded through a 1% statewide lodging tax. It was before his revenue committee that he chaired in 2003, and how long and, dare I say, contentious that discussion was during the 2003 session. I'm thrilled he chose not to spill his coffee on our laptops this morning. So anyway, he's a good man, and he helped move that bill through during the 2003 session. Have the opportunity to speak to you today, and I do appreciate the invitation to talk to you a little bit about the impact of the wine industry on Oregon's tourism industry, but I also took the liberty of adding the final line there in my title and said, and vice versa, because there is a great synergistic and symbiotic relationship between the wine industry in the state of Oregon and the tourism industry in the state of Oregon, and I hope to be able to amplify that message for you today. Specifically, let me begin by giving you some context for the size of the tourism industry today in the state of Oregon. This is based on independent research that we have done every year that measures the economic value and impact of the travel and tourism industry to the state of Oregon. So these are 2010 numbers that you're seeing here. Tourism spending in 2010 rose to $8.7 billion. That's up 28% since 2004. The reason I'm using that as an index date for you, by the way, is that 2004 is the year that the 1% statewide lodging tax went into effect. Tourism in Oregon now employs over 90,000 Oregonians. That's up 6% since 2004. Those jobs support about $2.1 billion in earnings. We're not only tracking payroll, but we're also tracking the sheer number of sole proprietors that the tourism industry in Oregon supports. Those earnings are up 24% since 2004. Tourism also generates tax revenue for the state of Oregon, for the federal government, and for local governments throughout the state. At the federal level, $468 million were generated in 2010. That's up 32%. State tax revenue was totaled $200 million approximately. That's up 22% since 2004. That state tax revenue, so you know, is tracking only corporate income tax, personal income tax, and highway gas taxes. In fact, the travel and tourism industry in Oregon generates approximately 20% of the state's highway gas tax fund. And local tax revenues are primarily in the form of local lodging taxes, although we do have communities that have rental car taxes and local meals taxes. Those totaled $110 million and were up 34% since 2004. If we take a look at the overnight trip profile, these are the total overnight trips that were estimated to come to Oregon in 2009. We're looking at about 27.5 million. And the piece of the pie that Travel Oregon looks at really being able to influence is that blue segment that you see there, that blue wedge that is referred to as marketable leisure trips. We obviously have a very strong and robust VFR market, as the industry would call it, VFR standing for visiting friends and relatives. You can obviously have some influence there. In fact, one of the interesting spin-offs from the visitor profile work that we did is that we found a very high incident of our friends and relatives, when they came to visit, staying in hotels. And the research firm said that that was probably due to one of two things. One, jokingly, we may not like our friends and relatives as much as we say we do, and so when we invite them to the state, we still have them stay in hotels. But what we really believed was happening, and what seems to be borne out here, is that when our friends and relatives come to visit us, it becomes an impetus for us to take a trip. We want them to see the state that we call home. And so we use it as an opportunity to show them the painted hills of eastern Oregon, the beauty of Crater Lake, or to help them tour the wine country as well. So let me dig down a little deeper and talk about this phenomena that is agritourism and culinary tourism, and really speak more to the topic here today. You know, we're very, very interested in this topic. We have elected to, over the past 2 years, to really focus our advertising efforts on two key pillars. One, outdoor recreation, and the second being the culinary offerings of the state of Oregon. Authentic and unique and memorable really describe that ideal culinary tourist experience, whether they're sampling pastries from a bakery that's been there for generations, they're tasting a famous cocktail from that bar that invented it, they're savoring a locally made cheese or chocolate, or happily partaking in a local or regional food event or some other consumption ritual. They're engaged culinary tourists. And many of the tourism, agritourism, and culinary experiences in Oregon have very strong culinary components. What we know from research that we help sponsor is that 17% of the American leisure travelers are engaged in some type of culinary or wine-related activity while traveling. This equates to just over 27 million visitors, just domestically, that we have as a potential market for us. We also measure how Oregon compares to the nation and to what we would then define as a competitive set of other state destinations to see how we fare. So here on this slide, you're seeing several key activities and experiences where visitors have told us how they see us comparing to the U.S. norm as a whole. And obviously you see some very strong comparison, especially in the areas of bed and breakfast throughout the state, breweries, and wineries. We're pretty much equally compared on exceptional culinary experiences and a little bit lower on that overall fine dining experience, but still very competitive. When we look at our competitive set, and our competitive set is for us is defined as British Columbia, Alberta, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, California, and Nevada and Colorado for both of our culinary as well as our outdoor recreation offerings. When we're looking at that, we find that our product image is positive when we're compared to the competition, both in terms of whether you're looking at unique local cooking or you're looking at great for farm vacations, especially when you're looking at those locally grown specialty foods or their interesting bed and breakfasts. We recently contracted to have some additional research done on how consumers, as they visit the state of Oregon, actually consume these culinary products. We learned a lot. We've learned, for example, that our visitors have a significantly greater tendency to actually engage in culinary activities than the U.S. population in general. We learned that about half of all of Oregon visitors bought one or more local food and wine products as they traveled the state, and wine was ranked number one. More than two-thirds of those who were surveyed took the Oregon products home, either for themselves or as gifts, spending roughly $142 in that category alone. And over one-third of all Oregon visitors said that the opportunity to sample and buy those local products had some influence on their selection of Oregon as a destination. So you start to get a little bit of a feel here for how, yes, the Oregon Tourism Commission has the charge to position Oregon in the marketplace as a viable visitor destination, but the presence of the wineries and the microbreweries and the artisan foods are a draw as well and help influence that decision-making process. One of our most concentrated efforts is done in the fall in a program that for the last 7 to 8 years has been referred to as the Oregon Bounty. We used it then to try and address what was a fairly common problem for tourism destinations around the world, and that is the seasonality in their tourism economies. We really saw an opportunity here to bolster that fall shoulder season by looking at what's happening in the wine country with the crush, with the microbreweries throughout the state when they're doing their fresh hop tastables now around the state, what was available at the farmers markets. There were just great opportunities here for us to look at a very specific seasonal promotion. We know that we were seeing explosive growth in the wineries in Oregon. When I first became involved in the tourism industry in Oregon in 1988, I would estimate roughly that there might have been about 75 wineries in the state of Oregon. Today, and Charles will probably correct me when he gets up here, but you know, to my knowledge, we have over 400 wineries in the state today, and nearly double that in terms of the number of vineyards. So this was an opportunity for us to be able to capitalize on these activities that were already occurring and bring together other artisan producers of all flavors, the distillers, the craft brewers, the bakers, the pork farmers, and others, and also celebrate what the chefs were doing that were drawn here. Whether you want to call it locavore, whether you want to call it farm to table, farm to fork, whatever it may be, it's been very fortuitous for Oregon's future and for Oregon's tourism industry. And we work very aggressively to make sure we're able to tell the world about Oregon's Bounty. Every year with Oregon's Bounty, we look for new ways to try and bring this whole idea to life, these extraordinary culinary landscapes and the personalities that make it magical. Last fall, we referred to the Oregon Bounty campaign as the Oregon Bounty Wander Feast. So now you're probably asking yourself, what in the world would a wander feast be? Well, it's a word we made up, quite candidly.
Who came up with it?
Well, it was a term that was coined between our team at Travel Oregon working in conjunction with our advertising agency at Wieden & Kennedy. The year before this, we ran the Oregon Bounty promotion was referred to as a cuisine internship, and the opportunity for folks across the country to submit a two-minute video for why they would want to come to Oregon and have the opportunity to win a chance to work alongside a chocolate maker for a week, a winemaker for a week, a brewer for a week, a charter fishing boat operator. We had an experience in every region of the state that consumers here domestically had a chance to win, and that's why we took the word cuisine and the word internship, did a little bit of a mashup, and turned it into the Oregon Bounty Cuisine Internship campaign. The Wander Feast was born out of the idea that these chefs love what they do in the kitchen, but they have other things that they do as well. So the Wander Feast idea was to take 10 chefs and 10 tastes they love and take them to that part of the state and let them kind of celebrate the other things that they like to do. We had chefs that enjoyed making wine. We had chefs that were making cheese. We had chefs that were steelhead fishermen on the Deschutes River. And we took them, we followed them, and then we created these long-form videos that we would be able to show online and turn into advertising campaigns as well. So the entire campaign ran about 10 weeks, and that's how we referred to it. The Oregon Bounty Wander Feast, 10 chefs, 10 weeks, 10 tastes that they love. And it really served to amplify our effort. And as you can see, one of those activities featured the Wine Week as well. This plan featured over 126 million impressions. That's 126 million sets of eyeballs that were able to see this campaign over a 12-week period. That was a 130% increase over the number of impressions we were able to generate in 2009. We also run online advertising campaigns in conjunction with this. Here you're seeing an example of what we refer to as an expandable banner ad. On the far left, you see what the ad would have looked like when you popped open the website. It would have been nestled in one of the navigation bars on a respective website that we would have purchased advertising on. When you clicked on it, then that middle frame would open, and you would see one of these Wander Feast videos appear and introduce you to every region. It would be it was kind of a mashup of all seven of the different videos, so you could get a sense for all seven regions of the state in one very quick video. And then it would go to the menu that you see on the right, so you could look at how you could explore the various tastes that we were celebrating in the state of Oregon during the Wander Feast campaign. We also carry the message about Oregon's culinary scene and the wineries out through our e-newsletters. We've grown the number of subscribers on our e-newsletters from 70,000 just a few years ago to over 160,000 today. We've also produced a very specific food and drink website that celebrates the wineries, the breweries, the artisan distillers, the restaurants, the farmers markets, and foodie events throughout the state. It includes suggested itineraries, events, and a whole database that visitors are able to search. We've also converted this to a mobile website, so it's available on your phone. We did not go with an app-based format where you had to choose between an iPhone app or an Android app or a BlackBerry app. Instead, what we did was a web-based app, so it's able to operate on any phone system that you may be, any cellular phone system that you may be operating on. Obviously, it's not just about paid media, though. I've spent a lot of time so far talking about the paid media side of it, but we work a lot in the earned media, the public relations and communication side as well. Here's just one illustration of an article that recently ran in Time magazine where the journalist said, "When I found myself heading to Seattle for business recently, all I could think about was Portland and Oregon. This Oregon city is America's new food Eden, a confluence of every fertile trend in contemporary gastronomy. Locavorism, the new naturalism, food trucks, and so on, they're all there." Or this New York Times article that ran recently, "Oregon is hiking country. It's also wine country, with vineyards that are increasingly destinations for wine lovers. So perhaps it's no surprise that the combination of hiking and wine tasting has a new name, Wiking." And Brad Niva with Road Wilderness Adventures down in Southern Oregon actually coined that name and promoted it and worked aggressively to help get this story run. Brad is one of the most innovative outfitter guides in the state of Oregon and has developed specific packages. When you raft the Rogue River, you can do Paddles and Pinots, which is his wine celebration. He has Paddles and Pints if you want to focus on microbrews. And if you decide to take a more fitness-oriented approach, he's now offering Paddles and Pilates. But truly, it's marketable. He has been selected by National Geographic Traveler as one of those trips you need to take before you die. I mean, Brad has really made quite a name, not only for his business, but really in promoting the Rogue River in Oregon as well. Of course, Representative
Just
Johnson.
A comment, but my wife and I love engaging in wiking around the Columbia Gorge, but we do it on bikes.
Nice.
Not on our feet.
We'll need
it's
to come
a great
up
way
with
to
a
navigate from
take biking.
We're biking.
Biking
we have wineries that are within 2 or 3 miles of one another. It's very easy to travel from one to the other with a loaf of bread and your cheese and
beautiful.
All that kind of stuff. And it's a great day to way to experience your community.
Beautiful. Thank you.
That's you guys.
Can you operate a bicycle after drinking wine?
Yes, it works just fine, Representative. Thank you.
We also took
one of helmet.
Thank you, Representative Matthews, for taking a pass.
Crazy, Mr. Chair. The
whoops,
filter engaged and everything. It was like, it was right there. And I... No, please continue.
We also took one of our print publications that we were doing twice a year and moved it to an online format. It's on magazine.traveloregon.com. We're now able to produce it every quarter. And again, wineries and the culinary offerings in the state of Oregon are just foundational to the messages that we keep putting out. Here you see a particular story under the banner of an Oregon dreamer telling the story of a family and the winery that they operate here in the state of Oregon. One of the biggest changes for this year is that we have migrated away from what has traditionally for Travel Oregon been a print advertising campaign. If I was sitting before you 5 years ago, I would talk to you about how we were spending about 90% of our dollars in print and about 10% of our money online. If I was sitting before you 3 years ago, I'd be talking about how we were spending about half of our money in print and about half of our money online. Today I sit before you and I tell you we're spending about half of our money in television advertising and about half of our money in online advertising. So with the Oregon Bounty celebration underway, the fact that we've migrated into broadcast television advertising, and we're here today to talk about wine, of course, you know, we could not have run this campaign without running a wine advertisement. So we've developed a series of 15-second television commercials. Mm-hmm. They are brief, but they tell an impactful story, and the reason for 15 seconds is what we do is we will literally go into a commercial break that runs roughly a minute long, and we'll take the 15 seconds on either end so we get you as you're leaving the show and as you're coming back into the show, let somebody else buy the middle. That way we're able to get the effect of a 30-second commercial with two different messages about all that Oregon has to offer. Let me show you that wine advertisement that's running this fall right now.
There are places you can go and drink wine with other people who like wine, but in a place called Oregon, you can drink great wine with the person who made it.
There are indeed other states that are making wine. In fact, somebody told me recently that there is wine being made, I believe, now in all 50 states. Doesn't mean there are grapes being grown in all 50 states, but there is wine that is being made in all 50 states.
Nice wine.
So what is it we can talk about in Oregon that's going to be unique? Well, the quality of the wine is superb, but the experience that you have there can be so intimate and personal because our wineries, so many of them are boutique wineries with a certain size of production, and it would not be unusual that if you stopped at that winery and had that taste of wine and it was being poured for you, it's probably being poured for you by the man or the woman who made it. And that's an incredible experience and one that you will not find in every other destination. So some of the impacts of the Oregon Bounty, just looking back at 2010, what we found visiting wineries is a key motivator for travel. We put the messages out there, and we found that 63% of the folks that traveled here during Oregon Bounty specifically visited Oregon wineries. Now, you'll also notice that they talked 76% talked about eating at local restaurants. You know, not everybody's going to get out and experience the wine country, but they will want to come here and experience Oregon wine, and they will often do that then through great Oregon wine lists at Oregon restaurants. But it's not all domestic. It's international as well, and what you're seeing up on the screen right now are the most recent results of research that we contract with Visa credit card company to actually secure. They have a product called Visa View Travel where we are able to see the activity of international visitors coming to and traveling within the state of Oregon and using their Visa cards. So it gives us an idea of how many folks were able to actually estimate came to Oregon during that time. We take those numbers and combine them with some other estimates that we have through our welcome centers and the airports and the like, and Craig Lindberg with Oregon State University Cascades Campus actually pro bono takes all that data, creates the algorithm, and gives us these estimates of international visitation. What's very nice to see is that if you look at a rolling 12-month estimate that ended June 30 of 2011, that middle column there at the very top, the total for all international was up nearly 14% for rolling 12 months. That's coming out of the recession. Nationally, they were national international visitations up about 9%. So we're running about 50% stronger in terms of our recovery. Part of it is because during the recession, we didn't take our foot off the gas in our international marketing. We just think it's too important a place to be. A lot of the growth is occurring in the international markets. And so we continued our investment there. And as we came out of the recession, not just domestically, but globally as well, our numbers are showing some very strong growth. So at the international level, the wines are strong. The wines are an important part of that message as well. Here you're seeing an article that is running in the most recent edition of Delta Sky magazine, the Japanese language version. This is from the October 2011 issue, and as you can see, it's all about Oregon sustainable wine and sustainable food. It's also key for us in Europe. A year ago, last October, I was able to travel to Munich to participate in a travel show. And rather than just have our standard booth, we worked with the show organizer, and Oregon was selected as the featured destination of this particular show. And we were able to serve wine at our booth as a result of that. We were able to provide a seminar about all that Oregon had to offer. We put a dinner on for several of our key clients and brought in Chef Bob Neroni, who's with EVOO Cooking School in Cannon Beach. And then we also took over the Columbia Sportswear store in Munich and did an event there. They literally closed the store to other guests, and we took it over, had music, had Oregon food, Oregon wine, and trip giveaways, and we invited, again, tour operators, travel agents, and the media, as well as their key consumer clients, to come and participate in that program as well. In France, again, Oregon wines can compete, both in France and the German language travel guides that you see here. The wines are competitive, the wine experience is highly competitive, and certainly something that we choose to showcase there as well. We have French tour operators who are offering tour products now. They are selling these packages to bring folks to Oregon to experience Oregon's wine country. In Canada, you see that Taste of Oregon event. We hold events in Canada and with our Canadian tour operators and Canadian consumers, and we also generate Canadian press on the Oregon wine country as well. We do a lot of independent research to make sure that our messages are on target, that we're hitting the right markets with the right messages at the right time. So we contract this out independently, and at the request of the state economist, we had actually gone out and had our research reviewed by another independent research firm to make sure that our results and our methodology were both consistent and conservative. What we found is that our most recent advertising campaign that we measured generated over 1.4 million new trips to the state of Oregon with $329 million in new visitor spending. Basically, what that means is for every dollar we spent buying media, we generated $193 in new visitor spending. We generated $8 in state and local tax revenue, roughly $5 at the state level and $3 at the local level. But the other piece we did, and this is the vice versa, if I can kind of close the loop on my opening slide when I talked about the impact of the wine industry on Oregon's tourism industry and vice versa, here's the vice versa part for me. It's been a theory of mine that if we bring folks to Oregon and they have a great vacation here and they return home feeling very satisfied with their vacation experience, we've done half of our job. But if we can bring folks to Oregon and we so connect them with this place that when they go home, they're changed. They're seeking out Oregon products now when they've returned home. They're looking for Oregon wine on the wine list or Oregon brews at their local brew pub. Or they're looking for Oregon food and Oregon-labeled products when they're shopping. Then we've really started to tap into the potential for Oregon's travel and tourism industry. So this was research that we just ran this spring to find out if this theory really could bear fruit. What we found is that 85% of Oregon visitors said that they were very or extremely satisfied with their experience here. This does not mean that 15% were dissatisfied. Okay? In fact, 13.5% were neutral. They were just kind of in the middle. On a scale of 1 to 5, they would have given us a 3 and said, yeah, we were satisfied. It's kind of what we expected it would be, and we had a nice time while we were there. 1.5% of the folks said that they were dissatisfied with their vacation here. 1.5%. The three primary reasons that I noted in the survey, weather. That they were dissatisfied, weather,
ring,
traffic,
yeah.
And then I love this one, their vacation was too short. They were dissatisfied with their vacation because it wasn't long enough. That's a beautiful problem to have.
A bunch of whiners.
See, weather and traffic, you must have been in Washington County. I'm from Washington.
We found that 43% now say because of their visit here, they are more or much more likely to purchase Oregon products than they were before they traveled here. So we're now growing the market because folks have come here and taken a vacation here and returned home. We've grown market opportunities for Oregon producers and manufacturers.
31% have actually purchased those products, not once, twice, or three times, but several times. I could have shown you a bigger number if I would have looked at once or twice or three times, but I was really interested in the number of folks that have become consistent consumers of Oregon products, and they told us, since visiting here in 2010, they have purchased Oregon products several times, most notably wine, microbreweries, and the artisan foods, especially the cheeses and the chocolates. And then to kind of close that loop, 42% of these folks said that now by taking these products home, remember they were purchasing them for themselves or as gift items, now they're home, they're introducing their family and friends to these Oregon local products, they believe that that will greatly influence the decision of their friends and relatives to visit Oregon in the future. So again, the product becomes the promotion. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have, or you may want to hear from the representatives of the Oregon Wine Board first, and then I'm happy to remain for other questions that may come up. Thank you very much.
Good. Just before you do, I'll get to Representative just a moment. I guess one thing that I was thinking about, too, that you didn't mention is you mentioned in general the economic driver of tourism. Mm-hmm. I've always been intrigued, you know, in the building here from when it was built, we have our carpets reflecting the economic drivers mm-hmm. of that era, you know. Mm-hmm. Number one was agriculture, number two was forestry, and number three is commercial fishing. Not quite the correct order. Tourism is number two. Number three, do you know?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, candidly, it really depends on which index you'd like to look at. Mm-hmm. If you look at export-oriented industries, which means we wouldn't necessarily be talking about healthcare, education, et cetera, if you look at those industries that actually export, and tourism is an export. If we have folks from Washington State travel to Oregon on a vacation, that is an export. When visitors from Japan come here and spend their dollars, that is an export because they are purchasing an Oregon product with dollars from outside the state. Tourism is the number one employer of all export-oriented industries in the state of Oregon. Now, if you look at something in terms of total economic impact, in terms of contributions to the gross domestic product, we're probably ranked third or fourth. If you look at total employment, we're ranked third. So depending on the metrics, you would see some variation in there, but we're certainly one of the top five industries, regardless of the measure you may look at.
Okay. Representative Doherty.
Okay. First of all, this is very interesting because I represent people in Washington County, and I remember when Ponzi started, mm-hmm. and it was just such a small little, why would somebody want to go through, and it was that when they and some of the others in Yamhill County started, it was kind of like, oh, the hippies have come in and they're starting to grow wine. And it really created a
how
huge,
easy.
Yeah, and that was in the 70s. I remember when they did that, and so it was such a huge thing, but I think of not only the drivers that the wine industry have done for tourism, but also for the communities, because mm-hmm. they're always ones that are donating to dinners and everything else with their local products. The one thing I was surprised is that, at least on the chart that you have, that people coming strictly for culinary, because the Food Channel and all these others had Oregon, had Portland's number one food destination city mm-hmm. for quite a long time, so I was kind of surprised that those numbers were down. But I'm also encouraged, not only, and it wasn't kind of a flash in the pan, because I remember during the Oscars one year when The Aviator and Sideways had been nominated for Best Picture, and people clamored to McMinnville mm-hmm. because they had the Spruce Goose there and they had the wine industry. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was going to be kind of a flash in the pan, and it has continued to grow. So mm-hmm. I think with what the Wine Board has done and what you guys have done, it really has created a whole new industry. I'm thinking, you know, we always think of Hood River as apples and cherries, but mm-hmm. it's wine now.
Yes,
and also.
Yeah. Yep.
Mr. Chair,
and considering the day after Thanksgiving, Washington County will be very crowded with vans.
We don't do that.
Yes, it will.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, great comment on the ranking where you saw us compared to the U.S. norm mm-hmm. for offering these extraordinary restaurant or culinary experiences. And it did appear as though Oregon's score was lower. And indeed, in terms of the ranking, it was. That was 08. Or 09, and for us, we almost see this growth curve that's just like this. I mean, it's just amplifying itself over time. That's part of it. Secondly, there are great foodie destinations in the United States. There's no doubt about it. And if, when you ask folks to list those, obviously New York and New Orleans and San Francisco and a number of places, you know, we're tending to come to the top of the mind for folks before Oregon. Now, when you asked about wine destinations specifically, Oregon becomes very competitive. But if you look at the culinary as just a category unto itself, yes, mm-hmm. but not as high.
Because you may not be looking at Oregon as a whole, more of just a small section of the state.
Correct. So. And that's why with the Oregon Bounty Promotion, what we've really done is been able to draft off the amazing work of the vintners across the state mm-hmm. and add all these other culinary components to it so they get a sense for not only what is produced here from a cheese and chocolate and beef and pork, et cetera, standpoint, but also what the chefs are doing mm-hmm. with it and what's available in those yeah. farmers markets and try and get those numbers up. So, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
You began with some data about the increase in travel numbers and visitors and so forth over the recent history. How do we compare to our neighboring states? Do you have any idea how, regards to, say, Washington, Idaho, and so forth, what kind of growth they're seeing in their visitors and in their travel, you know, programs and so forth?
I do. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we do some comparative analysis. Many of us contract with the same firm. Thankfully, it is a Portland, Oregon-based research firm that is doing the economic impact analysis. And the state of Washington, states of California, and the state of Idaho have all used them at different times. Our growth has consistently been comparable. Where you see the quickest jumps are when we went from having a roughly $3 million budget through lottery in 2003 to our budget growing to about $8 million because of the 1% statewide lodging tax that the industry came to the legislature and requested. Then you saw, we kind of reset the floor, and you saw some good steady growth over time, and then some more normalized growth as we strive to become more efficient in our advertising campaign. California, for 1 year, we actually, during that time frame, we had a larger budget than the state of California for a myriad of reasons, which I will spare you today. They decided that wasn't going to be satisfactory, and so they put into place a $2 rental car surcharge, and their budget went from $7.5 million, which was the year we had about $9 million, and they had $7.5 million. They now have a $50 million tourism marketing budget with that rental car surcharge. So obviously, you saw some very expansive growth. On the other side, though, Washington this year chose to close their state tourism office.
Wow.
They're the only state in the country now that has no state tourism office. It's an exercise that the state of Colorado went through back in 1994-95, and over the course of about 2 years, they lost a third of their visitor spending and dropped from being in the top five of top-of-mind visitor destinations to basically about 20th. Just over the course of 2 years.
That was a budget cut?
That was a budget cut.
Yeah. Jiminy's, what a place to have done it.
That was a budget cut. And, you know,
with
what we're able to obviously put before you today with the research that we do, we obviously see the legislature's investment in tourism promotion as an investment. If we're able to put a dollar into our media advertising campaign and bring back $5 in corporate income tax, personal income tax, and fuel taxes, you know, we think that's a good investment. It will take some time to get there, and we know there's always decisions that need to be made at the end of the legislative session, which is why the industry came and asked for the 1% statewide lodging tax in 2003.
It's interesting. When I served in the Senate back in the 80s, introduced that lodging tax. That's when it originally began,
mm-hmm.
then the expansion later. So tourism has been neat to see it. And to realize it was going to be a driver.
Yeah. Well, you know Oregon wines have made it when you are at a restaurant in Washington, D.C., and an Oregon wine was $97 a bottle. So we've made it.
I saw a $130 bottle last Tuesday.
Yeah, well, and this was a bottle you can get here for $24.
Yeah,
so,
that was
yeah.
great.
That's great. Representative Johnson.
Just to comment, but it seems that the challenge that you all have at the Travel Bureau is to keep up with the evolution at the local level with what really is happening, not just in regards to the winery industry, but for instance within the brew pubs or the beer, craft beer, you know, sector within Hood River. You know, I'll just give you an example in our area. You know, we've Full Sail's been the, you know, the kind of the giant there, the microbrew location, been 5 or 6 years ago. The chamber began a hops fest in the fall. connected with the microbrewery industry and so forth, and people come and share their beer and so forth. It's grown so rapidly and exponentially that it is now the second largest tourist-driven event in Hood River on the calendar.
Is it really?
I mean, there were literally 10,000 people there on a weekend or on a Saturday this last October. And now they're looking for a larger venue, you know, but it's just amazing. But again, you talk to people, there's people from Seattle, Tri-Cities, all around, that come there for that experience, for that weekend, and the town is just full, but it's just something that's rapidly exploded, you know. And so again, as you talk about highlighting these things, you've got to keep your ear to the ground, because there's some really exponential organic growth going on out there that where the industry is really growing by leaps and bounds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, you're exactly right. You know, for those that are not familiar with these, what are referred to as fresh hop tastables, when the hops are picked fresh, you know, they can lose some flavor fairly quickly, but when they're fresh, and the beers that they're able to produce very quickly are different than the beers that will then be shelved and produced over time. And the fresh hop tastables are almost to beer what the Nouveau Beaujolais is for French wine, you know? And they really are becoming amazing events, and folks do really enjoy them. I do want to address your question, though, about keeping our ear to the ground on these things, and just comment, we would never be able to do this alone as your state tourism agency. We do this because we have amazing partnerships. We have a regional destination marketing organization in every region of the state that's either independent, private not-for-profit corporation in almost every instance, that is looking out for the Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, Oregon Coast, et cetera, and each of them has a very vibrant network of local convention visitor bureaus and chambers of commerce that they, you know, when we need to know, we do a call out and we get information back very, very quickly from them that there's a new fresh hop tastable that's occurring, you know, or something's occurring at a winery, there's a new event, a new concert series or something that might be being offered that we can then put out to the press and media through our channels, because we often will have the resources to communicate those opportunities that our local partners may not.
Anything
else? Very interesting.
Thank you very much. It's exciting to get updated, and it's pretty hard not to get excited about tourism and the money it brings in. Thank you. Good. Our next presenters are Charles Humble and Anna Harry Peterson, please. Thank you for your patience.
I just need to switch the cords real quick.
Okay. Yeah, let's just take a moment here. In fact, maybe I'll go get some more coffee, since we are not serving better items today. But there is coffee and a little bit of snack over here if anybody wants it.
I'll stay just in case there's any other questions that can be helpful with. That was your Shelley.
Oh, okay.
Or at least that was your IT guy.
No,
you don't.
You don't even think about doing it.
It's just falling.
When is our general meeting?
The 18th.
When?
The morning of
I probably should have gaveled us out, but we will resume our committee hearing and proceed. Please introduce yourselves and let's go.
Good morning. My name is Charles Humble. I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Oregon Wine Board and the Oregon Wine Growers Association.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I'm Harry Peterson Nedry from Chehalem Winery in Yamhill County. Also, for 7 or 8 years, a member of the Oregon Wine Board, gleefully now spending since January 1st time working in the vineyards and the winery almost exclusively.
Congratulations.
Yes.
Wonderful to have you both here. Please, let's proceed.
Okay. So Harry and I are going to sort of tag team this effort, and I'll provide some sort of baseline information on the industry, and then Harry's going to take off with some additional information and take a more sort of forward-looking approach to where the wine industry may be going. So, and I also apologize for the fact that we don't have, that I'm serving in lieu of an executive director whose chair is empty right now and is in the process of being filled, and we hope to be able to name a new executive director by the end of the year. So I expect you'll hear from that person at some point in the future as well. The Oregon Wine Board and Wine Growers Association represents more than 1,000 winery and vineyard owners throughout the state, and I would emphasize that we truly represent them. They're the ones who do the work and make all this stuff happen. So when you see these numbers, it is not, we are not the ones that are responsible for that happening. It is them. I'm sorry about that, but I was trying to get rid of that little gizmo on the screen, which, okay. So there are approximately 420 wineries throughout the state, and that's an increase of almost 100% in the last decade. So the industry is enjoying some considerable growth, and the same goes for the number of vineyards, and Harry's going to talk a little bit more about that growth. There are 16 ABAs statewide, and when I say statewide, I do mean statewide. A lot of the growth that's being experienced right now is happening in the Columbia Gorge and in Southern Oregon, where they're very vibrant and rapidly growing and improving wine industries. That represents about 20,500 planted acres of grapes, not all of which are producing now, but there's been a real fervor in planting grapes over the last decade as well. We are the fourth largest wine growing state in the nation, and I would argue that we are actually third if you focus on viniferous grapes. We are behind New York, but New York, only about 20% of their production is viniferous grapes as opposed to other kinds of grapes. And due to the much acclaimed quality of the Oregon wine industry, we have reached critical acclaim throughout the U.S., certainly, and internationally. And I would argue that our wines are one of the best ambassadors for the state of Oregon. Every one of those bottles of wine that goes out of the state has Oregon on it someplace, and it makes our state better known. We also, to tee off of Todd's remarks, we have a very active international program where we're currently focusing our efforts on Japan, the UK, and Canada. So to sort of crystallize the impact, we do an economic impact study, and we don't do it every year because it's fairly expensive to do, and we have been in the habit of doing it about every 5 years. We did one through 2010, so this is very recent information, and we released it in the summer. In fact, it was during the legislative session. And that showed that the overall impact of the wine industry in Oregon, and that includes the entire wine industry, so that's beyond just what Oregon wineries do, although we represent a huge part of that, was about $2.7 billion. And that's, in 1 year. And the Oregon wine industry itself accounted for about $1 billion of that. And that represented almost a doubling in growth since we did the last study in 2005. The industry generates more than 13,500 jobs annually, and many of those are well-paying jobs. The contribution that we estimate to the tourism is about $158 million, which is actually a fairly small percentage given the numbers that Todd showed you, although we believe we have, and as he would, I think, validate, sort of an outsized impact on tourism. And there's a lot of opportunity there, we think, to grow that that piece of the pie. And as I mentioned earlier, lots of vineyards being planted, and that those plantings, since we did the last study in 2005, represent about $126 million worth of investment in the state. Let's see here. One of the reasons that we're selling more wine is because our wines are becoming more popular. And this was part of our economic study, which was done for us by a research firm that specializes on wine economic studies in California. And I believe you have a copy of that, or a copy, an electronic copy has been sent to everybody. And there's much more detail in there. And the study, these two bars show the last time we did the study and the current study, and they showed increases in every area. People are more familiar with our wine, and that tends to be one of the biggest issues, you know, actually having heard of our wine. You know, but a big jump in terms of what they think about the quality of the wine. And then ask people if they had purchased Oregon wine in the last 30 days. And also some really nice figures there, going up over 60%. I think it's actually 63% answered yes to that question. And then an interesting slide on grape production versus our two neighboring states. And these are percentages, so they're not, you know, numbers of acres, but this represents, you know, you can see that we are growing in terms of grape production at a much more rapid rate than either California or Washington on a smaller base. And then I'll just close my part of this by leaving you with a quote from our chairman, Sam Tannehill, with Rex Hill and A to Z Winery, and this was a quote we used in our news release when we released the economic impact study in the summer. As you can clearly see, the numbers reflect that the Oregon wine industry is on a roll. We're doing very, very well, and I think even our numbers were surprising to not only industry, but I think to the people in the state of Oregon about what a contributor the wine industry has become to our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee, I think my role here is to bring some reality from the vineyard and from the wineries as to what's going on, both looking backward and looking forward, and to also respond to any questions you've got about what happens when the rubber meets the road in vineyards and wineries. Specifically, I'll take a look at what the history has been from what I think is an important metric, and that is the vineyards and what happens in the vineyard. What you see projected is a graph of wine grape acreage, and that acreage is pretty, this is very much a hockey stick sort of look at an industry that's doing very well, obviously slowed a little bit. If you take a look at the graph, slowed a little bit during the economic malaise of the last 3 or 4 years, but in general going up. You can see, if you want to, what varieties drive it. One of the things that we have to say is that the vineyards in Oregon are best known outside of the state for one variety, but that is really a variety that is a foot in the door, and that allows some of the other varieties, out, not just Pinot Noir, to get a lot of traction out in the marketplace, and so other varieties are quickly catching, if not catching up to Pinot Noir, at least quickly increasing their percentage of the pie. The next graph shows vineyards, and vineyards is where I like to think we're planted. This is a long-term crop. It's not something that goes in 1 year and you harvest it that year and you're done with it. This is something that once you've committed to it, you're there for 30 to 40 to 50 years. So this is a stable part of the economy. You can see that we are up in the 800 vineyard range. And what this might mean is, to some people, is that we've got huge monolithic corporations taking a look at Oregon and coming in and taking advantage of what we've got here, but that isn't the case. The next slide shows that, in general, we have increased in size for our average vineyard, but we are still less than 25 acres in size for the average vineyard. The average vineyard is a mom and pop sort of venture. It's a business that's very much single family, and we don't really see that changing. We're based throughout the state. The next slide shows the AVAs that Charles mentioned earlier. AVA stands for American Viticultural Area. It's a recognized region that is exceptional for growing grapes and is unique and is then recognized by the federal government, by TTB. And if you look closely there, you see the regions that span all the way from the Walla Walla Valley through Hood River into the Willamette Valley, down into the Umpqua and down into southern Oregon, 16 different AVAs that are exceptional for grapes. Currently, about three-quarters of what happens, both as wineries and grape production, are in the Willamette Valley. However, it's not limited to that, and a great deal of the growth, as Charles alluded to, is in areas outside of the Willamette Valley, so ranging all the way from Walla Walla through Hood River down into southern Oregon. And those grape varieties that go along in those areas are different than what grow in the Willamette Valley in general.
Representative
Thank
Johnson.
Mr. Chair. Just a comment about the AVAs. One of the issues that we encountered last session when we were working on that bill that tried to kind of level the playing field for events and the use of, you know, vineyards and wineries and so forth is that AVAs aren't limited by state boundaries. Mm-hmm. In the Columbia Gorge, for instance, it straddles both sides. You've got wineries in Oregon and Washington within the same AVA, and maybe you have the same situation over there in eastern Oregon, I don't know. But the issue that we were considering is that, you know, there could be different land use or different usability laws from one state to the other, and there was some real tension about handicapping one half of the vineyards or wineries within that AVA or binding them to a different set of land use regulations versus what's happening on the other side. And we wanted to try to establish a level playing field for those wineries and those vineyards within that AVA. So there can be a lot of confusion and sometimes some complicating factors there that we don't consider when you just look at a map of Oregon like this. So it was an eye-opening thing for all of us.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating to see this. It's bringing back some memories of hearing in the business committee in the Senate in 87. Mm-hmm. We were talking about, that was when we began to expand and allow export of sales and so on, but we were talking about this very issue, and we thought we had very limited ground that would work for grapes at that point, and that was what people told us. And they also said a very limited variety of wines could be produced. Mm-hmm. And we thought maybe Pinot was going to be the lead, and then we would have some limited production of white wine, but that would be pretty much it, I remember, was the official testimony at the time. And it's been fun to see how the world's been transformed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, those points are well made, and especially the cross-boundary side of things is something that we actually enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
We enjoy the fact that Washington and Oregon, and currently there aren't cross-boundaries with any other states unless the Snake River one goes into Idaho.
Yes.
But and I don't know the answer to that. But one of the things that it does behoove us to do as a state, and we've taken strides over the last 3 or 4 years, is to work things in concert with Washington State. And so when I was on the Oregon Wine Board and was actually the chair that year, we, for the first time, met with our counterparts in Washington to address both marketing into the region as opposed to individual states, and also some of the wrinkles that cross-border AVAs brought to us. And those we looked at not as challenges, but more as opportunities to really take advantage. But you're right, uniformity is definitely something that is helpful in that range. One thing I would like to do is thank the legislature for what has in the past been given to the Oregon wine industry to help along the way. You mentioned 87. There have been a lot of times when the industry, even when the industry was 8 or 10 prime core members, and now, of course, a lot more people from a lot of different areas. The legislature has been receptive to some of the requests from the Oregon wine industry. Specifically, farmland protections we consider very critical. The state and winery organization, state winery organization that we have, what is now the Oregon Wine Board, during the early years had to be created to give statewide basis to it, and the legislature came along and allowed us to do that. Along with it came a self-taxation responsibility for the industry, so we are probably the most, if I'm not mistaken, the most heavily taxed wine region in the state, in the United States, and possibly even in the world, and it's all self-imposed, and that is to provide marketing, to provide research for the industry. That said, we've had to come back occasionally and reform that, morph it into a different organization. So 8 years ago, we came and requested the creation of a semi-independent state agency, the Oregon Wine Board, and its auxiliary Oregon Wine Growers Association. And the legislature was able to put the structure behind that has continued to make us successful. The other thing that has happened more recently is that dollars continue to go into research at OSU. There's a good educational support at OSU for both grape growing and winemaking sort of technologies. There is research that goes on there that's funded in several different ways, including our own taxes. We also have had the need over the last few years, we saw it especially, had the need to have a center for Oregon wine and grape research, and so we have created the Oregon Wine Research Institute, and that's based at Oregon State. It is not a building. It is basically a virtual institute that pulls together all the people who can very efficiently use the funds that are given it for the research in the industry. So thank you for what's happened in the past. If we look to the future, we would see never a loss of farmland protection as something that we should be focused on. I think it'll always be there. I think there's always going to be that nexus of growth in urban areas competing with growth in farm areas, and we're always wary of encroachment into fantastic grape growing lands. If we're looking back some years ago, to your point, Mr. Chair, there were times when we didn't realize what the great grape growing lands were. They aren't lands on the valley floor, they're on hillsides. We might say we grow great grapes in the Umpqua Valley or the Willamette Valley, but they aren't in the valley. They're on the hillsides of the valley. That's the ideal place to grow them. Those are not great traditional farm lands. And so protecting those farmlands from tracts of homes or other things is necessary in our opinion. We realize that there needs to be a balance, but we also realize it's very easy to build a housing development. It's very hard to move it back into agriculture later. Farm labor and immigration issues in the future will, I would think, be at least something we're addressing, whether it's addressed mainly nationally or federally, we don't know, but we know that it's all in our best interest to attack it rather than to allow it to passively eat our lunch. research support needs to continue to go. There are some regulatory issues that occasionally crop up. Considering the regulatory issues that were addressed by the Washington populace last week, I think it was, or the week before, during the referendum, we see it possible that movements like Washington's movements might come into adjoining states like Oregon, and we don't know what the impact on the Oregon wine industry is of that, but I would think that you will have to address that at some point. And tourism, the encouragement of the tourism process is critical as far as we're concerned. Obviously, there is a symbiotic relationship, as was described, and we very much appreciate it. A great deal of the money that comes into small businesses in the wine industry comes from directly interfacing with the consumer and to having the consumer purchase directly from the winery, as opposed to having to go through several different levels that filter out some of the profits that really should reside in Oregon. This is the Oregon that I see in the past and that I see in the future. I've been in the industry. I started looking for my first vineyard land in 1979, so I've been here not as long as the David Letts and the Dick Eras and the Dick Ponzi's, but kind of in the second wave. I was picking up things they dropped along the way as they got into the industry. But I've seen a lot, and I see it as a very vibrant, cooperative industry, not as a competitive industry, one that I think can be emulated in a lot of other business practices. Thank you, and I would love to respond to any questions myself.
Questions, comments?
Just Representative Johnson.
Question. Is there a ballpark number or figure on the per acre investment that needs to go into the ground for a winery? And then how long is it until there begins to become a return on that investment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, now, in this day and age, and it differs based on when you went into the business, this day and age, someone starting into the business for land as the underlying asset, and then the improvements on the land, you're spending usually $25,000 or so per acre for prime vineyard land. You're then adding onto it $15,000 to $20,000 of improvements per acre. You normally come online anywhere from 3 years to 5 years. The vineyards that I've developed over time, some of them have come in very quickly, but that's only because we threw a lot of money at drip irrigation and various other things to augment. The traditional is usually 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. So significant investment out of pocket prior to any sort of return that's going to help to amortize that investment.
There is a joke in the wine industry, which is not a joke, it's a reality, and that is that to make a small fortune in the wine industry, you start with a very large one.
And obviously, there's no guaranteed return on that investment either, especially in a year like this with the weather that we had and so forth. And it was a real struggle for some folks to even be able to get to the point where they could pick. You know, the sugars weren't up and so forth. And when you harvest, you don't know really what you have until you do your work as the vintner and so forth. So it's a challenge. So I applaud those who are investing in Oregon with some real money that will be here for the long haul, we hope.
Anything else? I thank you. It's exciting to have a little review, and we thought it would be important to kind of go through this. There may be some tweaks that need to be made in maybe session coming up in a year or so, and this might be one of the logical committees in which to do that. So thought people needed to get informed, and congratulations on outstanding work.
was interesting. I just got back from a trip to Turkey, and in central Turkey, they have some amazing terraces that these people have carved out of these rocky hillsides. Mm-hmm. And to some of our surprise, of course, wine has historically been one of the big products. And out in Cappadocia, which is a very interesting area, they created special little caves for the pigeons to roost because they discovered that pigeon proceeds are among the world's finest fertilizers. So I just thought I'd give you a hot tip that's about 10 centuries old.
I do have to comment on the brewing because a family that are dairy farmers in Washington County, and they would look at the early vintners and go, what are they doing up there? Because you couldn't farm up there. You couldn't have the cows up there. You couldn't farm. And they're now laughing all the way to the bank, those people from the hills.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, laughing to all the way to the bank many times means going back to the bank and considering continuing that line of credit. And so, yes, it's an ongoing small business with all of its travails. There was a hippie element to the industry when we all began. Mm-hmm. But the good part of the hippie element, in my opinion, the back to the earth, let's understand what's primary, and let's go back to making things and seeing, no matter whether it's food or beer or wine, I think that's what the tourism is responding to also, is an innate need to understand what our roots are and what is a basis for not only livelihood and something to drink or something to eat, but something to take pride in, and that is a craft, and that enjoys expertise. Mm-hmm. You can accomplish a great deal in an industry like this.
Yeah, and no matter how bad or good the economy has been, I've never seen a winery turn down a community request for help.
Oh yeah,
they are very good
about
community.
Twice a day, we have requests to help out the community, and you wouldn't believe how much what percentage of our product we give away.
Yes, I would. Yeah,
very generous. We appreciate that. Thank you. And just a different aside too. Sherry and I travel quite a bit, and it's intriguing to me that in the last few years, conversations when they find out we're from Oregon have drifted to the scenery and the weather, from the scenery and the weather to the microbrews and the wines.
Mm-hmm.
The word is really getting out there.
Because anything drinkable is Oregon.
And well, they are really.
That goes to teas, it goes to coffee, distilled spirits, just keep going down.
Yeah,
how about water?
Our water. Yeah.
Even pure water. Okay, we thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all. Okay, and next is an update on Oregon's job market. And Graham Slater is here to help us with that. And again, we have some refreshments on the side if anybody's interested. Wonderful. Great to have you here. Please introduce yourself. Let's proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Graham Slater, and I'm the research administrator with the Oregon Employment Department. I've been before this committee a few times, particularly in the last few years, and I'll apologize right away. I was expecting a little more time, so we're going to move very fast some of these slides, with your permission, with an eye on the clock, too.
Appreciate you doing that and being flexible.
And the other thing I'll say is that, unfortunately, I think much of the information I'll present isn't quite as rosy as some of the presentations you've just heard. You know, that niche has got some great stories to tell, as you've heard. In the broader economy, the stories aren't so great. So what I'd like to do is share a presentation that our staff's been working on for the last 2 or 3 months, really. And it's an ever-evolving presentation. And as you can see from the title, it's about the key workforce challenges we're facing as a state.
Yep.
And it incorporates the recent economic news, you know, different surveys we've done, even some just sort of news reports that fold in with the data. And it's a presentation I've given a couple times in the last literally 2 weeks, and there's many more on the calendar. So I think it's really getting some attention from folks just to be a good overview of what's going on.
Yeah. Well, and we appreciate you coming. And, you know, Representative Esquivel was just reminding me a few moments ago the new forecast is in, and it's down $107 million. So that's part of the reason you're here is these are not the best of times in lots of areas.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. And even as we've been sitting here, they've been announcing that, I think, next door. So let me just pause for a second and say on the screen or in front of you, here are the 8 workforce challenges that I'm going to talk about. And I'd like to ask, as I've done with other audiences, don't let your mind go to the 9th one that you think should be on the list. I'm happy to talk about that. We can email about it afterwards. But what I know the natural thing is to look for the one that you think's missing and then sort of lose the whole next 20 minutes of thinking about the 8 that are here. And we absolutely acknowledge this is an evolving presentation. Okay. There may be things on here that don't belong here 6 months from now, and there may be new things on there. So know that as we go along, and I will just give you 2 or 3 slides on each of these, again, moving pretty quickly. The first one, obviously, is unemployment. I mean, you're all very aware of what we've been through in the last few years. And this graph shows the number of unemployed in Oregon. And the good news is it's down from where it was, certainly at the worst of the recession. The bad news is that it's still far, far above where it was before this recession. And, you know, just to take rough numbers, we were running around 100,000 unemployed in some pretty good economic times. And that was a very interesting discussion at the time. Why are there that many unemployed when businesses were desperate for workers? Well, that's not today's discussion. Today's discussion is 180,000 unemployed. And as we'll see, it's not just the fact that they are unemployed. It's also where they come from and how long they've been unemployed that I think is a particular concern. In this graph, the upper line that you see soaring up there in 2008, particularly 2009, those are people that have lost their jobs. Okay, so they didn't choose to leave. They're not brand new students who just graduated. They're people that were working, and they lost their jobs. And you can see in the beginning and the early part of the recession, that's the number that soared. That's why the unemployment numbers went so high so fast. It was this concept called job losers. Okay, now many of them did nothing wrong. A few of them did, and they lost their jobs for really good reasons. But most of them lost their jobs through no fault of their own. Their company shut down, or their company cut back 20 or 30%, or there was no work for their company. What you see towards the end, the middle line jumping up, those are what we call entrants. And some of those are just students who have just graduated, so they're getting in the labor market for the first time. But others of them may be family members or spouses. And you can see this number bumped up at the beginning of the recession, and it's now bumping up again. These are people maybe whose spouse lost their job, And the second spouse or the family member wasn't even in the labor force, wasn't even looking for work, but now they decided they better. And as this recession's gone on, we probably are also seeing some of those discouraged workers that you hear about, people who simply gave up looking for work. Now they're hearing at least that things are stable, which is a whole lot better than where they were 2 years ago, and so they may be coming back into the labor force, and ironically, they're adding almost as much to the number of unemployed right now as were the original job losers. So the next slide, I think, is the key. The top part of this slide are people who have been unemployed for at least 6 months. And what we're hearing from businesses and what we're reading is that this is becoming a really big problem. Obviously it's a problem for these individuals and their families, but it's also becoming a problem in that businesses are, at least in some cases, sort of reluctant to hire these people. They feel like they've been unemployed this long, there's something wrong with them. You know, why haven't they found a job after a year or even 2 years? Maybe now their skills aren't as fresh as they were when they first got laid off. And you know, personally, just from the reading and the data that I've seen, I think certainly there's some people probably over 2 years who haven't made a great effort to find work. But I think the vast majority of people have been looking for work, and I'll show you data in a second that simply says there simply aren't jobs out there. In fact, I'll throw a number right now. There's 180,000 unemployed. Last time we did a vacancy survey, which is a year ago, and we're in the middle of this year's vacancy survey, but the numbers don't change that much. 180,000 unemployed compared with 30,000 job vacancies. So, you know, if the attitude is, well, all of those unemployed just kind of need to get going and find a job, there simply aren't enough vacancies, any kind of vacancies, seasonal, turnover, whatever, there simply aren't enough vacancies to get those unemployed back to work. And we'll see that in a couple of the others. as I said, you know, there's a feeling that once the economy picks up, all these folks will go back to work, but that isn't going to happen, partly because some of them have been unemployed a long time and businesses are cautious, and partly because the industries adding jobs aren't necessarily the industries that laid off a lot of workers. And we'll see that in a second when we talk about some structural changes. I'm going to skip these slides. You have them in front of you. It's basically a brief discussion from a business meeting that I spoke at, and during the lunch I invited their kind of roundtable comments. Talks about maybe why businesses are hesitant with these long-term unemployed, and then this next slide talks about what those long-term unemployed could do about that to make themselves more attractive to a business. Long story short, if they've been active, productive, volunteering, doing something useful during the time they've been unemployed, businesses are more interested. If they've been sitting around not doing a lot, then businesses are pretty skeptical about work ethic and so on. Number two then, structural changes to the economy. What we've seen in this recession, manufacturing, as you probably know, took a real big hit, as it does in most recessions. Construction took a massive hit, 35%+ job loss across the entire industry. So, you know, a 35% job loss in one large company would be a big deal, but when that's the entire industry, that's huge. And other industries have also taken some hits, but those two are huge. It's really interesting when you look at manufacturing employment. The bottom three shading areas here are manufacturing employment, and a surprise may be it really hasn't dropped in Oregon over 30 or 40 years. It has, however, dropped as a percent of the whole employment in the state. And you can see employment here going up by almost 900,000 at a time when the manufacturing sector pretty much hasn't changed. And therefore, if you take manufacturing as a percent of the total, that's the bottom three combined, you can see it's a gradual downward slide simply because everything else has grown so much where manufacturing wasn't growing at all. But I would point out that's talking employment. And if we look at production in manufacturing, like the United States, Oregon is actually producing more than we've ever produced in manufacturing, and we're producing more per worker than we've ever produced. So, you know, some of the story here, and it's not just technology, it's true in food products and wood products, some of the story here is we are producing tremendous amounts, but with far, far fewer people than we ever needed before. And it's a good thing in the sense of surviving in a global economy. It's a bad thing in the sense of good paying, good benefits, manufacturing jobs simply not growing. Construction is a clear bubble. Many, many people said that the employment level of 105 or so thousand simply wasn't sustainable. But I don't think many people thought we would drop as much as we did. I mean, clearly this recession, the severity of it has been very severe. And so you can see construction really down at levels of 15, 16 years ago. You know, some people talk about the lost decade in terms of employment, but in construction, it's a lost 15 or more years. In other words, we're back where we were 15 years ago, even though overall we're a growing state. So that one has been huge. And there's been some growth, but out of 35,000 jobs lost, if you add 1,000 or two, that's still a lot of unemployed construction workers who have the skills. They were doing it 2-3 years ago. They're not doing it today. It's also worth noting that structural change isn't always negative. In Oregon, I think we always think of it as a negative thing, mostly because of the wood products industry, and it has been very negative, particularly in rural Oregon over the last 30 or 40 years. But here's an industry that just keeps growing. That's a structural change, too. Healthcare just keeps growing no matter what the national policies, no matter what, you know, the changes in laws and so on. This graph goes back a good long time. And I think of one industry that you could really think there is a you know, notable shortage right now of skilled workers, healthcare would be the prime candidate. And you can see the reason here. So number three, yes, we have a lot of unemployed people, and the problem is we simply aren't adding enough jobs. This one shows the month-to-month employment change. Some of you have probably seen this before. Red downwards is bad. That means we lost jobs that month. Green and upwards is good. We added jobs that month. And you can see late in 2010 and into early 2011, we had 5 months in a row of pretty good job growth, and there was this sense of we've turned the corner. Yeah. You know, we need to add 1,000 jobs a month just to keep the unemployment rate pretty much where it is. We need to add about 3,000 a month to see the unemployment rate coming down measurably. And we thought late last year, early this year, maybe we've turned a corner. And then you look at the last 6 or 7 months, and it really statistically, out of, you know, almost 2 million jobs, this is sort of in the error range. So we might say 1 month it went up 500, and the next month it went down 1,000. that's really just statistical. You know, this is all sample-based. You know, this is not a significant trend. So the bottom line is the big, big layoffs are done. That's been done for a while. But we're simply not adding jobs, and that's why there's still 180,000 unemployed, because we're simply not adding jobs. So we started doing a little survey twice a year. The last one was in spring. We're actually wrapping it up right now and analyzing the results. But we asked businesses what they think is going to happen in the next 6 months. And it was just a four-question survey. And we said to them, you know, do you think there'll be no change in your company's employment level? Do you think there'll be an increase or a decrease? And what you see here is that 62% said, I don't think there's going to be any change. This was in the spring. And it looks like they were right, because overall employment barely changed in 6 months. And a few of them, 19%, said an increase, but 7% said a decrease. You know, so there's not a lot of difference there. It will be very interesting when we see the one we're just wrapping up to know how it changes. On the right, when it says, why not hire, the fourth question says to them, you know, basically, what are the factors that are causing you not to hire or to be, you know, to be limited or cautious in your hiring? And I think it's interesting only because we hear a lot sometimes about, you know, it's government regulations and taxes and so on. And clearly, that may be true in certain economies. Very nice. But in this economy, the big thing is the economy, the uncertainty, that maybe the finance, the credit. 49% said just the general economic conditions, the recession is what's worrying me and causing me not to hire. Much smaller percent said other things. This one, as I say, it may have become obsolete half an hour ago in the next hearing room, but basically I think, you know, the graph, you wouldn't tell the difference probably. The graph is probably still looking like pretty steady but not rapid growth as we look out the next few years. And I think it's still true that the third quarter of 2014 is when we get back to the old employment level. And again, you know, this has happened since we've all been sitting here. Think about that, though. We bottomed out in the fourth quarter of 2009. It didn't take us that long to crunch into this recession, but it's taking us 5 years to get back to the original employment level. And again, we're not going to get back there in manufacturing. We're not going to get back there in construction. We'll get back there in some other industries, and they'll take us above the level. As we look to our 10-year projections, also being released in about 3 weeks, we don't have the final data to publish yet, but here's a kind of a cool little graphic that gives you a sense of what we think will be growing and adding the most jobs in the next 10 years. And again, the bigger the words, the bigger the deal, and healthcare is clearly there. Note, though, that there is growth in construction, there is growth in manufacturing from where we are today, but in neither case are we going to get back to the old levels. So, you know, they will come better than they are today, but not back where they were. I'm going to skip that slide in the interest of time. Business is struggling to find workers. This is just a very interesting one. 180,000 unemployed. In fact, this next slide puts it in perspective. I've already said 180,000 unemployed, 30,000 vacancies. And the employment department system, our labor exchange, helping job seekers find jobs, helping businesses find workers. I was in a meeting just a couple weeks ago where the next numbers were shared. 204,000 individuals are in the employment department's labor exchange system, and right now we have 7,300 job openings in that system. You know, that's not a very good match, right, for those 7,300 people. And what we do know, of course, is that some of the jobs, I'm sure those people would qualify for. You know, I would make the case that in many cases, if there's a construction job open today, there's got to be construction workers who have the skills to go do it. If there's a healthcare job open, maybe not so much, because really no one, very few were laid off from healthcare. Massive numbers laid off from construction. I'm going to skip through some of these. You can look at them. I can come back and visit at a later hearing if you want. But these basically just talk about some reasons why maybe businesses are struggling to find workers, even with this massive number of unemployed. And I was just reading an article this morning that also says maybe businesses, knowing that there's this huge number of willing and eager workers, maybe businesses are being very, very picky about who they hire. This is the market when they can do that. But it seems very strange in most industries when businesses say we can't find workers with the skills we need, when we know, compared with 5 years ago, there's this massive labor supply out there wanting to work. Now, some of it is about different industries growing and different skill levels and different geography. It's pretty hard to move to where the job is if you simply cannot sell your home right now. I mean, in addition to all the normal reasons why it's hard to move. This challenge number five is just one that I think we have the least data on, but it comes up in a lot of our discussions and meetings, and it talks about connecting the training to workforce needs. And I guess the takeaway message here is that overall, this slide somewhat shows it, overall, it looks like Oregon has about the right balance in terms of associate degrees and bachelor's degrees, you know, for what businesses say they need for different jobs. Where it breaks down a little bit maybe are those degrees in the right fields? You know, are there enough healthcare? Are there enough engineers? Are there enough whatever? And then also on certain jobs, you know, are we providing exactly the kind of welding training or machining or whatever it is, you know, areas that I know very little about, but are we providing the exact kind of training that businesses want, even if the title of the training has the right words? Is it the exact skills that the businesses want? And then there's the balance of at what level is it the business's responsibility to do that final tweaking to their particular methods as opposed to the colleges or the private career schools. So this one's sort of a placeholder that just says everywhere we go talk about this, we hear this concern, so we want it on the list for further discussion. Number six, I think we've talked a lot, and our number seven has to do with baby boomers, who, you know, everybody thought were going to retire, like, imminently, and now, of course, they're not going to retire as soon as they thought, for the most part. But we haven't heard as much discussion about younger workers, and we've got some great data on this. I'm just going to summarize it by saying, think about the college graduates who graduated in the summer of 2008. And many of them were not able to find a job in their field in the summer of 2008. So by the summer of 2009, then they're competing with their own graduating class and a bunch of new graduates from 2009. But 2009 was a horrible year. So now you go to 2010 and we added hardly any jobs. You come to 2011 and we've added hardly any jobs. It's very easy to see graduates from 3 or 4 years ago who are now competing with this huge number of people from that field. We're still not adding that many jobs. They've lost 5 years of their career path. You know, for many of us, those first 2 or 3 years, you know, you're getting those pay raises, you're maybe getting that first or second promotion, and they've lost that forever. Even if they get a job, say, next summer, they've lost that forever, and they have $50,000 or $80,000 in debt. So I think this is a real big deal for some of the young people that we all kind of need to be aware of. Just this one New York Times article, 56% of the 2010 graduates had at least one job, compared to 90% just a few years ago. So, you know, just one number to kind of make the point. This one talks about living with parents.
I think that's one of the scariest things about our recession is there are some of the economists who are talking about this may be the first American generation not to be better off than their parents.
And Mr. Chair, one of the slides, we have like 80 slides in this whole presentation. Yeah. Of course, we pull things out depending on the audience. One of them talks about that. I think the number is 50-some percent themselves believe that they will be worse off than their parents' generation. So, you know, so that's a little discouraging when they didn't start out college that way, maybe.
Yeah.
This one also talks about not just the college grads, but the teenage workers. And, you know, maybe all of these teenagers who are not working are at home studying, and it's going to be great. Usually when I say that, I get some smiles because, you know, maybe they're losing some real work skills and work experience that would serve them very well later. But again, a lot of the jobs that teenagers typically take are being taken by middle-aged or older workers now. And you actually see that as you do business around different types of stores. The baby boom retirements, I think, is one that's pretty evident to many of us. All you need to see on this one is how big the blue bars are as we get to the current most recent data. In other words, a much higher percentage of our population now in that older age group. This one's actually the workforce even, not just the population. The takeaway message on this one is that in the big numbers, we actually probably will have enough workers. We did a study on this about 2 years ago, and you know, we attract a lot of people, including a lot of young people, to Oregon. And that's not necessarily true to some of the rural areas, which I'll mention in a second. But for Oregon itself, we probably would have enough warm bodies, if you will, to meet the business needs of hiring people. Whether or not those warm bodies have the right skills, or are they in the right geographic areas, that may be a little more dicey. So it's kind of one to be aware of. And that leads me into the eighth comment, which has to do with rural areas. If you look across Oregon as a whole, about 1 in 5 workers is probably within 10 years of retirement. Okay. If you look at places like Wheeler County, which I know is very, very small county, but about 1/3 of the workers, and even places like Lincoln County and Curry County at the coast, well over a quarter of all workers are within 10 years of retirement. And those places, as we'll see now, are also struggling to keep their young people. So I've traveled Oregon, you know, 28 or so years with the Employment Department, meeting with people, giving speeches, visiting our offices. And I've traveled all those rural areas, and I love visiting those. And I think some of these numbers are actually very concerning and disheartening in a sense. The basic message about rural areas is that almost everything I've shared with you statewide is slightly worse or significantly worse in rural areas. I mean, that's a quick takeaway. Unemployment rates, as you see right here, are typically higher in rural areas. The number of workers who are 55 and older, the percent of workers, is typically higher in rural areas. I actually gave a speech over in Newport to an economic development forum about 3 weeks ago. And one of the participants at the end in the question and answer session talked about that and pointed out, just look around the room at the age of the people participating and how worried he was about future leadership within the county, business, government, whatever kind of leadership, as you look at the age there. And I'm just going to end with this one, which we just pulled off a couple weeks ago from some census data. I've been around long enough to have, I came just during the 80s recession, which, as you know, was huge, right? So that was my introduction to this stuff. Yeah, great start. But even in those days, we were saying things like Baker County, Klamath County, Coos County, you know, places that were hammered in that recession, they're still growing in population. And that was remarkable because it wasn't true in Nebraska and South Dakota and some other places, probably areas of Michigan these days. Now, if you look at population between 2000 and 2010, the two census periods, you can see here 8 counties actually lost population over that period. That's pretty unusual from what we've seen. And worst of all, 14 counties have fewer young people now than they did 10 years ago. So that's kind of a whole different dynamic for some of these rural areas. And it starts feeding that economic development concern of how do you attract new 20th century information type companies if all your young people are leaving and, frankly, moving to Portland or Seattle or someplace where they think there's a lot more opportunities, and in reality there probably are some more opportunities. So don't have answers to it, but I think it is one of the great challenges we as a state are going to face. Mm. And that is a very fast presentation. I'd be happy to take questions if the chair would like it for a couple minutes, I guess.
Thank you. I appreciate you really moving through this quickly and... some pretty eye-opening stuff. I'm sure we have some questions. Let's start over here with
Representative. He raised his hand first.
Okay. And then I guess you're next, and then we'll get to Conger, and we'll just keep going. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
The components or parts of your presentation that deal with education piqued my interest, and especially at the end as you talk about the drain or the mobility of our younger students, potential students, out of some of those rural communities, rural counties and so forth. And obviously one of the things we're trying to encourage, and there is some great progress happening on this front, is the virtual education aspect within our higher ed system to ensure that there are opportunities for kids in these more remote areas of Oregon to still access our OUS system or community college system and so forth, so that they can stay there if they choose to and need to and want to get the training, and then they remain there as potential hirers or, you know, workforce. So that's a huge component, I think, of what we're trying to do with our higher ed policy. But I think, you know, the other thing, obviously, is you talk about types of degrees and, you know, and training and equipping and education and all of that. You know, much of what we're hoping to implement in policy in February will begin to address that question as we talk about achievement compacts with community colleges, universities, a whole K-12 system and so forth, to ensure that we aren't just sending people out the door with fluffy degrees that really don't lead to an occupation or a career. So again, we're making some progress on the policy side to address some of these concerns, but they certainly aren't going to be quick fixes for the unemployment picture. It's a very long-term trajectory, as well as that whole 40-40-20 aspirational goal that we're now, as kind of, as the governor says, the North Star that's going to direct us on our education policies and so forth. Great long-term goals, but in the short term, we still have some real issues and so forth. So I appreciate your presentation. It's been very good.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Doherty.
Yeah, I have 3 questions, and I will remember the third one. And they all deal with manufacturing. And I think one thing with manufacturing, and if you're looking at the 40-year period, has manufacturing dropped nationwide?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, yes, manufacturing employment, I'm sure, has dropped nationwide. Okay. Now, again, manufacturing output, as we saw, has increased.
Okay, because I'm thinking, I know the things that I've read is manufacturing is kind of, you know, where it was such a large part of our economy for so long that it's just not as it's still very important, but the manufacturing companies just aren't there anymore.
Well, and Representative Doherty, I think the companies that are there, again, are employing far fewer people because they can produce with fewer people because of technology. I do know from just national committees that I've served on, you know, for a lot of states, manufacturing has just been going down consistently, kind of regardless of recessions. What we've seen in Oregon is that in a recession, it does tend to go down. But after every recession in Oregon, it's bounced back up. But it's like the bouncing ball. It never bounces back up as high as it started.
Or so a job that used to have three people do the job now because of technology, maybe one person.
Or those old jobs have completely disappeared, and the new jobs are the people running the computers, running the technology. Okay. So it's kind of, you know, there's still jobs, but it's a completely different type of job.
Okay, so that leads me to my second question, because you were talking about job training needs in manufacturing. What sort of job training needs are, I mean, are we looking at welders those kind of job training programs, K-12 programs and community college, is that what is needed?
I would say in some part, Mr. Chair and Representative Doherty, certainly some of the folks from community colleges would be, I think, better able to answer the details on that because they're the ones responding to those needs.
Okay, got it.
But conversations we've had even during this recession, I think some of those are, you know, the assembler, the machinist kind of jobs. Mm-hmm. And then some of them are those technology jobs. And part of it is, one of my slides said this, but I breezed right by it. There's this mindset among college graduates that manufacturing is not the direction to go.
Right.
And our data show that if you look only at growth, you know, it's not a true statement, but you can understand why people would feel that way. If you look at growth and retirements, the average age in manufacturing is actually pretty old. If we want a vibrant manufacturing sector, we need to have some of these young, highly skilled college graduates, engineers and computer and IT, moving into manufacturing also. But I think, you know, through their youth, they've just got this sense of manufacturing is on a decline. Why would I think of that as a career?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy if you take it too far. So we have materials that, you know, that we in the research division put out, career information that really points that out, that there's some industries that may not be growing rapidly, but when you add in the replacement openings, as we call them, Oregon needs skilled workers.
Right.
Otherwise, 10 years from now, manufacturing may be declining, not because of offshoring or anything, but just because there aren't any people to do those jobs. Millwrights would be an example that people often use.
Thank you for the expectation. And the third thing, and I caught a little bit of your presentation this morning, how much of the current Oregon economic situation is due to the world markets and the world economies? Is what the kind of economy that we have in Oregon, is that a major factor or a semi-major factor?
Mr. Chair and Representative Doherty, I certainly would defer to the economists who are in the next hearing room, you know, for a great answer, but I would say a lot of it. We've always maintained that we in Oregon, we can control certain things, and we can certainly go attract new businesses and make it a good place for Oregon business. But when you have the kind of national situation we had 2008, 9, 10, and the global situation that still is going on, I mean, none of us can control that. And that would certainly impact the construction industry when you look at the downturn there. I mean, a lot of that was way beyond our control in Oregon, and it's going to take a while to fix it. So I don't have a percent for you, but I would say a substantial amount of what we're going through is a national and global problem. And we're just suffering with the nation. Most states are in similar boats.
Yeah, because I have lots of friends that lives in a country that 4 years ago was the best economy in Europe, and now it's like in the tankers. And they are very, and it's almost identical to what we had. And it's like all of a sudden, the manufacturing and the computer industry in Ireland is going to collapse.
Ireland,
it can't happen. But yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Conger. Did you have?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Slater, I just to emphasize the point that was just made in your slides, the survey of business owners, it indicated 49% were saying the reason that they weren't hiring or the concern that they had was the economy, and I think that you know, obviously we are in a global economy, and I'm not sure that we in Oregon can do much to fix the global or the national economy, but we can respond to what we know, which brings me to my first question. I have two, if that's okay, Mr. Chair. The first question...
Permission granted.
Thank you. And thank you for the coffee, also.
Yes. Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you. I'll be nicer.
Okay. Now you're throwing me off my game. I forgot my question.
That was the plan.
So, yeah, I know. This is all a nefarious plan.
It's always great when you can confuse the attorney.
It's okay. I'll just keep talking.
Well, and you don't have the excuse that some of us have regarding age.
Oh, I thought you were going to say lack of coffee. So I saw a chart recently that depicted the various funding sources and programs that are involved in workforce training. And I know that that's not your area within the economic or within the employment department. I know your specialty is this research, and I appreciate that. So if you can't answer this question, it's okay. But after looking at that chart, it looks like spaghetti. So there's all kinds of funding sources. There's different programs. They appear in some cases to have mutually exclusive objectives, which is surprising given that they're all workforce training oriented. But in some cases, they appear to have some overlap, but they're still different programs. And one of the statements that you made is that we need to be training, and I think you were focused, again, consistent with the employment department's mission to get people back to work. You're focused on this population of 180,000 people who are looking for jobs but can't find them. We need to be training them with the needs of the employer in mind, which seems very intuitive. So what are we doing to accomplish that goal through that spaghetti-like array of workforce training programs?
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Conger, you're right that I would defer a much larger answer to this to our agency director, Lori Warner,
sure.
And Cam Preuss from community colleges. And, mm-hmm. and certainly there's a network of state and local workforce investment boards who deal with all the different funding sources. But from our point of view in the research division, we do provide not just this information, but those 10-year employment trends allowing for growth and retirement. We provide that, and it's used heavily by the community colleges, by Cam Preuss's group, and by the local workforce board, so that as they're thinking about, we've got limited resources, where should we provide training, they can make decisions, healthcare being an obvious one. They can look at our data, and again, maybe healthcare is too obvious, but they can look at that, and they know how many nurses or x-ray technicians or welders or machinists we project we're going to need in the next few years. We actually have, 3 years ago, we developed a prioritization model that they can use by region, even.
So you are localizing this to employers in the area.
Being workforce regions. And so they can look at that and say, you know, in the Bend area, here's the top 20 occupations, maybe that only require some post-secondary education. You know, forget the bachelor's degrees, just post-secondary. Here's the top 25 occupations, looking at demand and wages and so on, vacancies. Here's the top 25 that we better make sure that we're provided training for. So it's not just about the 30,000 job vacancies today. Really, you're training people, you hope, for the long term, for their career, at least with some transferable skills for their career, and while you're trying to get them back to work right now. So that was work we did. I'm frequently speaking with CAMS group and with the workforce boards, making sure that they're aware of this, that they're using it, and they do. If a community college wants a new program of training, they have to use this kind of data as part of their justification to get approval. So our part is very much tied into that whole decision-making process. The only other thing I would say is, in the last couple of years, there's been a big integration effort across our workforce system, so that the community colleges and the workforce training people and the employment department, we're even more integrated than before. And you know, I was curious when you said mutually exclusive, and I certainly don't have the expertise or time to deal with that. But you know, my observation, almost 30 years in the system, is that the employment and training goals are certainly in sync with each other. You know, so if there's some programs that are mutually exclusive, that would be an interesting discussion that Lori might want to have or can. But overall, we're very much in sync with each other.
And that really was the nature of the question, is are you communicating this data and the need that you're projecting in a way that actually gets to the training programs wherever they're housed. And when I said mutually exclusive, I have to offer a disclaimer, which is, you know, I was looking at a chart that was very confusing with lines crossing and everything, and all it had was title, you know, of program. So,
okay.
You know, I didn't really know what they did. I just was looking at the titles in the various lines, which were very spaghetti-like.
So as far as the information, you know, a very strong yes.
Okay. That's, thank you. That's good news. Second question.
Yes, please proceed.
So we saw in your presentation that some degrees, and we actually talked about the value of college degrees, not the value, but the employability of graduates with those kinds of degrees. And one of the slides that you put up, I think, had some indication that engineering and I think it was education degrees, graduates with those degrees were far more employable.
Mm-hmm.
Is that information being disseminated, for example, in high school counselors' offices or career advisory offices and things like that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Conger, I would say yes. We have a publication called Careers. It's a magazine-type thing. We send out about 200,000 a year to all the high schools, all the community colleges, all the workforce centers. And you know, and I couldn't point to page 63 that had that exact information, but the whole purpose of this Careers magazine, and it's also on our website online, is to point people in those kinds of directions. One of the difficulties, and I think it's a fascinating one, is that at least in this nation, we don't force people to go into healthcare or engineering. You know, they make choices of their passions and interests. So, you know, people can take degrees that may not lead to a direct job opening, and that's part of who we are as a nation. But we definitely get the information out to say, here's the types of things that are a direct link to jobs and jobs that are growing. And I'd also put a plug in for Oregon Career Information System. I mean, our careers information goes maybe this deep. Oregon Career Information System, which is in about 90-some percent of all school districts, their career information goes this deep. And that's what you'll find in a lot of career classrooms, career counseling settings, in the high schools, in the colleges. And they definitely, you know, go super deep. Students may do that during the classroom as part of the curriculum. So between us and CIS, I think there's a lot of information out there. And then, of course, people are making those individual choices.
Sure.
Well,
certainly, I don't think anybody would want to interfere with a young person's ability to choose their own career path, or particularly their own path to getting a college degree. But I just wondered, and I think you've answered the question, whether or not they had access to information that might help them, you know, among the many options that they have, pick a degree that would actually help them get a job after they graduate.
And our little catchphrase for our division is quality information, informed choices. I mean, my staff can recite that. Our job is to just give the best unbiased information we can, as like I'm doing this morning. And then whether it's legislators or high school students, you know, they can make informed choices. You know, and they know if they choose this, there may be less openings, but it's their passion. If they choose this, there's going to be lots of openings. You know, pretty much guaranteed a job in some, particularly healthcare, for example. So.
Okay. Representative Hoyle.
Thank you so much for coming. It's an interesting presentation. I wish there was something in here that I could just go, oh, there's an easy fix. We could just do this. That's what I was hoping for today.
We're
a little disappointed. But to have a comment and a question. The comment is, I was talking to some people in the building trades over the past couple of months, and one of the issues that they have is that because construction work opportunities are down, that young people are not going into construction, so we have older construction workers that will have to retire, and they really don't have the apprentices and people coming into the businesses. Representative Johnson knows, because he works in construction, not because he's old.
I think it's a matter of both.
Just wanted to clarify.
Did you need coffee also?
Got it. Apparently. detail. So, you know, getting young people to go into jobs that we know we'll need people for, even though there are no opportunities now, is really it's difficult. But again, I'm glad you identified it, and it's something we need to do. So my question is, this is just talking about employment opportunities, but it doesn't talk about, do you have a split as to how between public and private sector employment and the separation of growth or decrease in each? And and one of the things I'm thinking about is that in my district, I have people who want to retire, who could retire, and a younger person could get that job, but they're in a position where they can't because, like my aunt, her company got bought by another company, and she just lost her pension that she had planned to retire on next year and has nothing. I mean, really nothing. So, you know, and I hear it over and over again where people say, I could have retired, but my 401k went down, or I could have retired, but, you know, my pension's not there anymore. So what's the difference between the public and private sector growth?
Sorry, I was scurrying because I wondered if that would come up, so I had some data on that. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Hoyle, in the last year, certainly, there's been consistent growth. But most months, maybe 10 out of 12 months, private sector has been growing. And if you go back to the beginning of the recession, when I would give presentations like this, you know, I was consistently saying pretty much all the job losses are in private sector and government is just kind of holding steady or even growing. And part of that was the federal census, of course, which, you know, spikes every 10 years. And part of it was those stimulus funds, which for the employment department and many other agencies and school districts brought in some unexpected funds that helped. Now, we said at the time, though, that will change. You know, government budgets are largely on 2 or 1 year cycles. That will change over time, and we're at the point where it's changed, so that for most of the last year, private sector has been adding jobs, and government is actually down. I can just glance here. Since June 2010, for example, we'll just pick that, and this was the question we were asked yesterday. Since June 2010, the private sector has added 31,000 jobs, and that's up 2.4%. At the same time, government employment is down 10,000 jobs. So, you know, some of those graphs that I showed of that, you know, pretty wishy-washy growth this year, if we excluded government, it would look like at least a decent growth trend. But, you know, you've added 30,000 jobs, let's just rough numbers, 30,000 in private, but you've lost 10,000 in government. So net jobs is still only looking like a pretty weak 20,000, and that's in 15 months. So, you know, just over 1,000 a month. And as I said before, we need 1,000 a month just to keep the unemployment rate unchanged. And we're not meeting that because of the public sector losses. Now, there's still some private sector losses, but they're being kind of overwhelmed at this point by gradual growth in the private sector. But it's government that's taking net losses. And it's federal, state, and local, by the way.
Thanks.
We're going to need to wrap this up. Any final quickly, please?
Just a real quick, and I'm glad you brought that point forward. I know that we're about 4,000 teachers down when you include teachers and classified staff, and I know some of those are, in some cases, like a music teacher who's been reduced to 61% of a job. I don't know how you do that. I'm a firefighter. If they told me to go to work 61% of the time, I just don't know how that would work. But the point about an aging workforce is also very interesting, because I do see people holding on to their employment longer.
Exactly right.
For a variety of reasons. In my world, that means, you know, police officers, firefighters, 60-plus years old. I don't know the society, with no offense to the older generation, but I don't know the society is really looking to have that kind of a workforce representing law enforcement. But we'll see what happens. I guess my big thing is, I don't know that you would have the number of how many veterans are unemployed currently. You know, I know that with the leadership for good chair down here, Sal Esquivel, representative, we're dealing with that issue too. One of the things we're looking at is how we
can
take our
veterans.
An older
generation too, Representative Matthews.
I never knew that. I thought you were in your 40s. But how we can take the veterans' experience in the military and translate that into the civilian workforce without having to send them through long drawn out training if they're already qualified. If you can weld in Afghanistan, you could probably weld metal here. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at those opportunities. But I just appreciate your information. Very factual. You know, I'm going to take a more detailed, thorough look at it. But thanks for your testimony today. Thanks for your time. And yeah, I'd be interested if you have anything on telling us about our veterans. These folks left their jobs in some cases on more than one occasion to go and report for duty at the for Call of Duty. And then I just want to make sure that we're looking at those folks as far as underemployment and unemployed so we can get them back into the workforce as well. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, very quickly, the Employment Department does have a program that focuses particularly on veterans, and certainly I'm not the expert, but I'm sure at a future hearing, our director or someone could come and talk to you about that. I did give a presentation to a national veterans committee in the employment world probably about a year ago, and don't have the numbers in my mind, but we certainly could update that. It's just 6 or 8 PowerPoint slides. Yeah. We'll get that to you for sure.
And last quick point, Mr. Chair. I believe in your community, Clackamas Community College, November 19th is going to be doing the Hiring Heroes job fair, and it's going to also take place in Pendleton.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking forward to the employers. That's put together by Chamber of Commerce. It just shows business working together.
Same thing at Clackamas Community College.
That's what
I'll be there.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, please, quickly.
Quickly, just to piggyback on some of Rep. Conger's probing questions earlier. Our community college system is doing a wonderful job in being receptive to their local communities, and that's through their institutional boards that are made up of locally elected individuals who have their ear to the ground. They know what their communities need, and they are working with their college to have job creation, creating opportunities that dovetail the needs of those communities. In Hood River now, because of all the windmills we've got going up in the East Gorge, our community college has a wind technician program that's exactly for that purpose. It's a segue to get qualified people into the pipeline. It's an entry-level job. You're there. Bigger question, though, and you may not have time to go into this. I'd be happy to take the answer offline, but can we get out of this recession without a robust housing market? Is housing going to lead us out of this recession as it has in the past, or are we looking for the next, knight in shining armor on the white horse to lead Oregon's economy back?
So, one sentence answer, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. I don't think anybody thinks housing will lead us out of this.
Okay.
It's one of the reasons that the long-term projections are so slow.
So we're looking for a new normal.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, we thank you. One of the best presentations database I've ever
seen. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.
Committee, before we leave, a couple of business items. I believe we will have one final interim hearing between now and the session in January, scheduled on the 18th, at least at this point. If you have topics that you wish to have on the agenda, please send an email to my co-chair and I, and include Teresa, and perhaps even the committee, just to get some brainstorming going. We're looking for topics. And then, secondly, as I indicated earlier, we will be having the universal commerce bill before us. I think we're going to try to reduce it a little
uniform.
Bit to
uniform.
And I think, but at this point, that's only one of five bills. We still have openings, and I do think in certain ways, as I've talked to the business community, a lot of them say less is more for them, and stability is better than the potential of introducing bills that might go awry. Yeah. So I'm not inclined to move, but the process would be this, since we don't have time to work it out more as a committee. If you have an idea for a bill for the session that you would like introduced as a committee bill, the process would be to submit that to Chris and I, and copy it to Teresa, preferably to everybody, frankly. And Chris and I will make arbitrary decisions. I don't know how better to do that. And if you don't like that, grab us and we'll discuss
it. That seems fair.
You're all fine Americans.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any further? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the co-chair is considering using that January time as time when we can have informational hearings that could segue into work sessions, first session of February, or first week of February. Is that the intent if you have legislation that's ready to go?
If we have legislation ready to go, and I would love to do that.
We could do public hearings.
We could actually do public hearings. Anything else for the good of the order? We need to get out of here. Thank you all very much. And with that, we are adjourned.
So.